Big Red Bench. Game on. Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m.
The Joanne O'Riordan Podcast. A Big Red Bench production for Cork's Red FM.
Hello and welcome back to the Joanne O'Riordan Podcast, Episode 3, where we interview Sports for Business CEO Rob Hartnett. In 2012, Rob Hartnett founded Sport for Business, which is a professional member-based network of leaders, and he talks about what it's like to work in the commercial world of sport and what that means for us as fans and everyone involved in the sporting world. We discuss women in sport, we discuss organisations and sponsorships, and we discuss what it takes to be the sports star that's sponsored by everyone across the world.
Great, Joanne. Lovely to meet you. Lovely to be here.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Absolute pleasure, really is.
So your job is primarily sport and business.
It is. Yeah. It is.
What does that mean?
Well, it's a business that I set up myself 7 years ago now. And prior to that, I had worked in journalism and I'd worked in PR and I'd worked in sponsorship and had, you know, done incredibly well in all of those things, really enjoyed it, but always had in my mind the fact that between sponsors and rights holders in sports, that there were too many sponsors that were leaving at the end of a contract thinking, I wish I'd done that a little bit better. Mm. So I had this notion in my head that by creating an environment and a community whereby we could both try and educate and analyse and do some commentary on the commercial world around sport, particularly in Ireland, at the outset, that we would be able to help that wide community to actually understand each other a little bit better and to work a little bit closer together. And it took off. So we've been very happy. You know, we've got most of the major sporting organizations and, you know, pretty much all of the major sponsors that have come on board that we work with on a regular basis. Really exciting.
And what do like sponsors like say to you? What's their main reason for like leaving, for not like, you know, getting on another contract, extending a bit further?
Do you know, thankfully, that dynamic has actually changed.
Okay.
And it's something that a lot of the rights holders now are working towards as well. Dermot Murphy, a good Cork man who works in the GAA, he always says that getting the contract for the first time is far less exciting to him than a renewal of the contract. Mm. So getting that sort of second extension is something that really matters. So you're always working towards that. And it's a case of, you know, surprise and delight. So you're always trying to make sure that you're giving something a little bit more to the sponsor than they might have been expecting. And that can be difficult. I mean, you know, particularly in the GAA and in all of the major sports now, you're working with so many different sponsoring organisations. And, you know, this year we've got the Rugby World Cup and there's all sorts of different layers of responsibility and management and that comes in on top of it. So it's a complex arrangement for most of the big sports. Now, the small sports would look at that and would think, well, not small sports, but challenger sports,
yeah,
say. They would look at that and they would think, oh, God, you know, that's a real first world problem. But it is. And, you know, you're just trying to make sure that the sponsor is getting what they want out of it, which is often incredibly different. It's like any individual.
Yeah.
You know, it's from one person to another person will have different needs, different reasons for getting involved in the first place. And just making sure that that's, you know, that relationship is a really good one. And it's the same as anything. It's people and people.
Yeah.
That's what it is. So if you've got a really good sponsorship manager that's working really closely with the, you know, the people in the sporting organisation, then that's great. Everybody just sort of really switches onto that.
So I assume every sport is like different. Like I presume in rugby, it's a little bit more, you know, like it's easier. Like I always feel like there's a lot of rugby players out there all the time. Like you're always seeing Johnny Sexton's face on something. You're always seeing like Brian O'Driscoll, you know, or someone like that. And then soccer, you know, I suppose is a bit more different again. But like with GAA, is it a bit more like contained? Like you can't do possibly as much with the athlete because they're, you know, full-time professionals in an amateur world in a sense.
It is, you're absolutely right. That's it. Mm. You know, we talk about the GAA as being an amateur sport, and it is, because all of the lads, all of the women that are playing in championship actions throughout the summer, they will still turn up at their place of work on a Monday morning and they will have a career. So, you know, the life-work balance between a professional athlete and a GAA athlete has got an extra dimension when the GAA, because you are basically training and playing as a professional sports person, but you're holding down a career as well as trying to manage some kind of a life in between that as well. And so that does make a difference. The demands on your time are going to be far more challenging to meet as a, you know, as a GAA person. And also because it's so much more of a community sport, there's probably an awful lot more, you know, sort of almost emotional demands.
I was going to say, is that sexier than for a sponsor to come in? Like, is that like, you know, that they're like, wow, that's what I want to get in on.
It is, because there's, you know, there is something special about it. Like, I mean, we as a nation, we kind of, you know, we hold up our GAA heroes on a particularly high pedestal, because we understand they're of our community as well. Like, I'm involved in a big club up in Dublin Cooler, and we've got Conor Callaghan, and we've got seven of the players on the Dublin hurling team. We've got Martha Byrne and Jennifer Dunn on the ladies football team, and a scattering on the Camogie team as well. But to us, they're still players. They're players that turn out on our championship teams, on our league teams when they can. They turn up to our summer camps. We just know them. We bump into them on the street every time. Rugby is different now in the professional era in that people have moved into an environment whereby they know their training schedule from 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock. They know when they can sleep. They know when they can rest. And it's a complex arrangement for them as well. Into that, they have to factor their own personal sponsorship arrangements and their team sponsorship arrangements. So, Johnny Sexton might need to be doing something for Bank of Ireland, for Leinster, and then he might need to be doing something for Vodafone on the Irish rugby team. And then he'll have his own personal, which might be with Leia Healthcare, that he'll be doing as well. So you have to factor that in on a really professional basis as well. The GAA, it can tend to be a little bit more flexible. It's one thing being on the Dublin setup, where you know that it's going to be a very concertinaed summer, where every minute almost is devoted towards championship action. But there is still that little bit more time and also that little bit more demand, because the club always wants a little piece of you as well. And you want to give back to them as well, because that's where you come from.
Is it more difficult, say, with, like, say, non-Dublin teams? Like, and I don't mean that in a bad way. Like, obviously, the Dubs are, like, winning, the football non-stop around them, so it's probably easier to sell them. But is it harder to sell, say, like, maybe a Donegal player because he's so far away? Do you know what I mean? And a lot of business would be located in... Does that make sense?
It is, yeah. You know, that's a bigger societal issue about the fact of...
Oh, yeah, it's not your fault.
So many things being centred on Dublin. And I think that within your community, I think local is still... huge, like in Cork, if Pat Horgan wants to do something, or if a company down in Cork, or if Red FM want to use somebody, it's one of the Cork hurlers that you really want to go to. Or it might have been Paul Kerrigan, or it might be Ronan McCarthy, or it could be somebody down there. In Donegal, it's Michael Murphy, but Michael Murphy is on a national level as well.
Yeah, so
anybody can see the impact he has, both as a person as well as a player as well. There's something very special about, those leaders in their field. You've got Joe Canning in Galway. Like, Joe, any company would give their right arm to have Joe representing their brand, because he represents so much that's good about sport and about, his own personal approach to life and everything else. So it still does very much depend on the individual. But of course, in order to get a national profile, you have to be winning at a national level as well. So we talk about Michael Murphy and Joe Canning, but both of those have got All-Ireland winners' medals in their pockets. And you do kind of need to get to that. So, if you're a star midfielder with Limerick, or with Roscommon, or with Clare on the football side, you might still struggle to get just that recognition, and that's just a fact of life.
It's just life, yeah. Your life pre-sports, I thought, was kind of interesting. I was like that professional stalker, like on LinkedIn. I was like, ooh, I found him. But my favorite was you were involved in the 1-0 conference, and I remember I was like dying to go because Hope Solo was there. It was like after that incident you had with Lance.
Yeah, that's right. That incident.
Does that haunt you?
It doesn't. No. I'm a great believer that you kind of, you do something for the right reasons and why you think it is right. And I've no golden magical button which says that, yes, that's absolutely the right thing. So I'll make mistakes. I get involved in different things, which I think at the time are the right thing to get involved in. But I won't kill myself over, the ones that get away. I'd probably say yes to a few too many things. But I'll be honest, when you reached out to me, that was the easiest yes that I could make, because never
I'm
mind
honored.
Talking. You're an inspiration to so many people. And I do a fair bit of work with Paralympics Ireland and with Special Olympics Ireland and on the women's side of it. Now we'll come back to that and we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
But just in terms of what you've done is really inspiring, because it was something that came out of something quite simple. So the fact that you as you said yourself, that you had this obsession with Enda Kenny, so you wanted to get involved. And, it's on those little moments of your dad ringing up school and actually getting you out of school to go and meet him. It's the little moments that you could never plan. So you probably didn't realise, at the beginning of that week, that was going to be a week that would actually be something so important to you. And I think when you've got a story, you're brilliant at being able to tell it. And if you've got a story that will actually sort of register with people, about something which is not, you know, it's not, it might not be brilliant. It might not be something that you had planned out your life in advance and that you were going to be there at that moment. But when that moment came, you were in a position where you were able to actually do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And you've kept on doing that. So never mind about the stalking business. Absolutely brilliant to be here with you. And the, yeah, going back to Lance Armstrong, I was a bit uncomfortable with having Lance as being this sort of the keynote with 1-0. Because I believed in him for longer than I really should have.
Okay.
So he made me feel like a fool when it actually emerged that he had been doping all the time. And when I look back, you know, hindsight is 20/20. When you look back and you think, well, that was obvious. You know, how can I have been suckered into it? But I wanted to believe, overcoming the cancer and everything else. It was just such a wonderful human story that I thought, I just want to believe in it so much. And so I was suckered into it. And I didn't really want to, you know, want to give him the sort of the benefit of the doubt of putting it on. But the colleagues that I was involved with at the time, they were adamant. They persuaded me. And I listened to a podcast he had done with Joe Rogan. And I thought, actually, no, that is an interesting story. We're not going to be whitewashing, you know, Lance Armstrong.
So I was going to say, what was your aim? Like, you know, there was obviously a reason why he pulled out. Was it because of your aims of the summit? Or like, were you aiming to not clear him? Because I know that sounds wrong. Because as a criminologist, like, you know, we always give someone a second chance, you know. So like, you know, in criminology, we were always like, should Lance be given a second chance? And I remember it happened, the 1-0, and we were like, well, clearly he shouldn't, because clearly it's like a pathological thing with him. You know, like that was just the criminologist in us. Were you trying to give him, not a second chance, were you trying to give him like a vindicate, like to kind of sit up there and say, I was wrong? Were you kind of hoping that would happen? Or did you know he's not going to admit that he was wrong? He's going to be, you know what I mean?
We knew that he was going to be polished.
Yeah.
We knew that he was going to be, you know, like Quicksilver, that people will want to go and see him. You know, whether they like him or whether they don't like him, they'll want to go and see him. And the, you know, I think the thing that persuaded me and persuaded the rest of the team there was that you look at the world in which he kind of became so embroiled in, of this, you know, cheating in sport, doping in sport, the whole question of sporting integrity. And we know that we want to change that, but you'll never actually change it just by living in a bubble and by speaking to the people who are of exactly the same mind of you.
Yeah.
You have to understand the motivation behind why somebody is going to cheat. And again, you're a criminologist. I'm only, you know, sort of a complete amateur in this world. But the idea of talking to somebody who had willingly broken the rules to find out why, and not to try and get an apology out of him, that was never on the cards. He said sorry. He in his own mind has moved on from there, and nothing that we were going to do at a single Dublin conference was going to change that. But if that was able to help people to understand some of the motivations as to why people are doing this and moving change along that way, because we saw this in Northern Ireland down the years. You'll never get peace just by talking to the people who want peace.
Yeah.
You have to engage with the people who are intent on, you know, on destroying the system in order to bring them in order to actually get things working a little bit better. And even though it may sound terribly, you know, sort of egotistical or hubristic, we had a sense that by bringing him over and by putting him in the spotlight in this sense, that we could actually move that world of sporting integrity on a little bit more. And, you know, if there's something as big a picture as that you think you might be able to change by 1%, go for it.
Yeah, you should. Yeah, yeah. No, definitely.
Yeah.
Did you see his Architectural Digest feature? He had he was in Aspen. He had 10 fridges. And everyone was commenting on it going, why does he have 10 fridges? Like all the non-sports fans are just like, what's going on with 10 fridges? And the sports fan leader were like, you don't know. You don't need to know.
I missed that. But yeah, you'd have a fair sense, all right. He just like, maybe he likes smoothies.
You'd never know. He's, you know, children, you know, got to put them in their own rooms with all their fridges.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, he's in Aspen, you know, so I know it gets cold in the winter, but it probably gets hot in the summer. So you just want everything to be cool.
Definitely. I was interested in your life kind of working in the gambling industry. Like in my head, I kind of had an image of it being like maybe tough and hard, but maybe it's, I suppose, different to what it is now. You know, I mean, was gambling kind of like not cooler? Was it cooler back then? You know, I suppose we kind of know the dangers of it now, but is it, you know, was there a time when it was cool?
You know, I'm pleased that I've moved on out of it.
Okay.
That's not to say that I regret the time that I spent in it.
You must have learned a lot, because I think it must be a tough industry.
Oh, it is. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, I went into it, ever since I was a kid, all I wanted to be was a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And I did history and politics in UCD as my degree, because You know, I thought that would be a good way in.
So and, do all the cool kids in journalism, don't worry.
You know, and then you get a break. And, you know, I knew somebody who was in London. So I graduated out of UCD, went over to London. And my dad introduced me to somebody who was leaving a radio station there to go to Australia. And he put me in to do a couple of shifts. And I was able to speak into the microphone or into the phone when I did it. So they kept me going. They didn't pay me, but that's one of the things that you just have to cope with. Any future journalists out there, you'd have to just say yes to when somebody wants you to do something and just build up your experience. So that was the case with me. I did it for 18 months without pay. I was doing another job in public relations at the time as well. And then I got a job working for Ladbrokes, and I was in the press office. So I was always on the kind of the media and the marketing side of it. So I was on the glamorous side of the industry as such. But this was pre-online. So
okay.
One of the projects that I did when I moved on in one of the companies afterwards was with the Tote being one of the first companies to actually go online in the betting environment. And it was very exciting at the time. But as things have progressed and as things have moved on, you know, you're a little bit more uncomfortable with it now. It's so accessible and it's so easy to actually get involved that, you know, I recognize the dangers of it. Now, I wouldn't overstate them. Like, it's like, you know, some people will say, oh, no, gambling is such a horrible vice and it destroys so many lives, you know, and it does. But so does driving too fast.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean that you prevent people from driving a car. I think most people are able to actually sort of, you know, look on gambling as being a form of entertainment. So it gives you a stake in a match or in a race, and it gives you a sense that you own a horse the same way as JP McManus would own one, or that you own a part of, you know, Donegal GAA that you might not have otherwise got through your upbringing and things like that. So, you know, the fact of having a, you know, a small wager, I've got no problem with, but at the same time, I'm glad that I've moved into a wider environment now. I understand the nature of gambling, and I understand the psychological issues which it can raise in some people. So it goes from, it can tip over from enjoyment into compulsion. And
there's a quick line, like that blurring is quite...
It is.
And
those that are on that line are the last ones to recognise it.
Yeah.
That's the same with any form of addiction. I think one of the challenging parts about it is that it's so secret. You know, if you're addicted to drugs, it becomes physically very apparent. If you're addicted to drink, it becomes physically much more apparent as well. Mm. Whereas addiction to gambling, it can happen so quickly and it can destroy a life in terms of taking that money out. You know, the gambling companies get a hard time over not doing enough. They are doing stuff within there. They do work hard. The regulated ones, the better ones.
I was going to say, but is it like a case of let's not destroy the business, but let's also look like, you know what I mean? Let's look like we're doing something. Is that, you know, because from the outside kind of glass perspective, you think, oh, this is like a business trying to capitalize, but looking like they're doing something. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And it's, you know, it's an easy accusation to make. I've come across this in a number of different ways through sponsorship. And, you know, there's a lot of people that think that alcohol companies shouldn't sponsor. There's a lot of companies that think that McDonald's shouldn't sponsor the FAI and you know, and other sporting organizations.
Because that's what I was going to ask you. Like when you're doing sponsorship, like when I look at, okay, say I'm at a football game and I see a Carlsberg like ad across from me. In my head, I'm not like, oh, I'm going to go drink a Carlsberg. Like it doesn't put that into my head, but I know for a lot of people it does. Do you find that like a 1% is what you're looking after rather than a 99% sometimes when you're doing sponsorship deals like that?
Well, the alcohol companies will always say that they're not encouraging people to start drinking their brand. They're looking to substitute. So if you're promoting Carlsberg, you're looking to get people to switch from drinking Heineken towards drinking Carlsberg. And, you know, each of them puts their own messages into it. The question of sponsorship is one that does continually rear its head. And every now and again, people will say that the banks shouldn't be involved in sponsoring the GAA, that they're just trying to, you know, to greenwash their reputation, that they really shouldn't have, we in the GAA shouldn't have any hand, act or part in trying to rehabilitate them. But if you don't have sponsorship, sport takes place, but it takes place at a much lower level. So when McDonald's come in and they sponsor a football association, the money that they're putting into it actually encourages them to go out and employ more coaches, to get more kids involved. And if as part of that, some families look and they see, oh, well, if McDonald's are sponsoring football, then of course, then it's fine. I'll be able to go. That's not a straight line that you can draw.
Yeah.
So I think that you know, sponsorship is such an important and integral part of sport now at the highest level and at so many other levels as well. All of the summer camps that have been going on across the country, Kellogg's for the Cool Camps, Sports Direct for the FAI camps, Bank of Ireland doing a lot of rugby camps as well. They're all sponsoring in there. They're enabling it. They're enabling sport to reach out to a wider group of people. And in so doing, they're doing good. So, you know, your moral take on whether it's right or wrong for an alcohol company to sponsor is that's your particular take. And as an individual, you have to be comfortable with that. But so long as it's legal within the country, you know, we have, you know, very intelligent lawmakers that will decide what's right and what's wrong for us as a society. And it used to amuse me when there was this huge surge that the alcohol companies should be kicked out of sport. But there was never any question that they were going to be kicked out of music festivals. Now, if you look at the demographics of people who are going to a sporting event as opposed to are going to, you know, to a big festival, the demographic was always much more targeted towards younger people, more impressionable. They were going in there, you know, to drink an awful lot more than you would at a sporting event anyway. But there was never any question that you should take alcohol sponsorship out of that context. And that always amused and somewhat frustrated me at the time. But as I say, I move on.
You move on. Because actually my, you know, it's kind of rare, I suppose, that you would get like a sponsorship that works so perfectly. And I was kind of looking kind of online and looking like across sports that I watch for like a harmonious sponsorship where you would feel not semi-uncomfortable, but you'd be looking on going, oh, that's a bit weird now, isn't it? And I remember the darts for me, like the darts is like a big thing in our house. And I remember when William Hill came on board, you know, it was when gambling was, you know, it was okay at the time, like no one really paid much attention. But like you see what happens when a sponsorship works so well. William Hill and the Hearns, they brought literally the darts from the tavern to four continents across the world. Is that a rare thing to happen, like that you get something that works so harmoniously? And I presume the work behind the scenes is phenomenal to get that to that level.
It really is, because when a sponsor comes in to work with a rights holder, and it doesn't matter how big or small they are, they bring a skill set and they bring a set of experience which these days and for the last 10, 15 years, possibly even more, has gone so far beyond the idea of writing a check. Originally, sponsorship was intended to be, you know, the prerogative of the chair of the company, so that if he or she liked Gaelic football or triathlon or swimming or rowing, then they'd ask the marketing department to just write a check and give some money to X, Y, or Z so that they could actually do it. These days, the relationship is so much more intertwined, and huge part of it is the promotion of it as well. So again, if you look at the GA and the Cool Camps that have taken place all across the summer, Kellogg's have been involved in there for a number of years now. And a big part of that is the fact of putting the Kellogg's Cool Camp promotional messages onto every box of Kellogg cereal, which is on sale in your Lidl or your Super Value or your Dunn stores. And getting that message across to families at the point where they are thinking, OK, so I'm going to do this. Now, if it was down to just the GAA or even just the local clubs to promote that, you wouldn't have the same heft, you wouldn't have the same reach to actually get out there and make it work. You know, so that kind of thing of the company bringing in its promotional messages to it is hugely important as well. I tell you one that worked incredibly well and made a really big difference as well was Allianz work with Paralympics.
Okay.
And they've done that on an international scale, but also at a local scale in Ireland as well. So that Allianz are a, you know, proud partner of Paralympics Ireland.
And the ad haunts me a little bit with the choir. I can hear it in my sleep sometimes.
Right. Yeah. But you know, some of the ones like the special one that they've got with Ellen Keane at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, and sort of, you know, bringing her and her kind of journey through life. And, you know, they've done this with a number of individuals. But one of the key things was that when we were getting ready for London 2012, Paralympics were out looking for a sponsorship because it was going to be, they had a sense that this was going to be a tipping point in terms of the Paralympics and the Olympics, which was absolutely right. But the Irish Paralympics team had been down in Beijing 4 years earlier as well. And there was this wonderful showreel of about 45 seconds of seeing athletes in action in an Irish vest on the, you know, in the Bird's Nest Stadium and in the pool. And I remember watching it with Liam Harbison, who was the CEO of Paralympics at the time, and saying, that is just magic. How much of that have you got? Have you got more of that that we can actually sort of, you know, push that out and potentially attract in more sponsors? And he said, no, that's it. That was it. It was 45 seconds that they had of that coverage. And what Allianz did with London 2012 was they came on board, they were sponsoring the team, but they also sponsored the broadcast coverage. Mm-hmm. And it was with Setanta Sport, which became Air Sport at the time. And then that encouraged RTE. And they enabled the fact that we could actually see the incredible feats, you know, that Irish athletes were doing, regardless as to whether they had, you know, missing a limb or whether they couldn't see properly. You know, we were always used to seeing the Irish athletes competing at the Olympics, and that's great. But seeing them in the Paralympics, just it meant so much more. And because London was such a wonderful time for Irish athletes as well, we had so many athletes coming through and winning gold and winning medals. We might never have seen that had it not been for Allianz coming on board. So that's a real life example of where sponsorship can make an enormous difference other than just putting a brand onto a shirt.
Is it harder? Because I remember we had Niamh McCarthy in the Discus Thrower, and we had her in, and I was talking to her about like when sponsors come on, does she find it awkward that it borders on like inspiration porn is what I call it. Like when you're pushing someone out there and you're like, look at how little she has, but how much she can do. And she was saying that it actually, at the start, it didn't really bother her as much, but now she just wants to be seen as an athlete. Do you think that transition is kind of happening more and more now? Are they a little bit over it? You know, the fact that they're like, oh, yeah, I know what I'm missing, you know, I know what I'm lacking, you know, but please focus on what I can do instead.
I think that is absolutely a point. I think any sport is inspirational mm-hmm. in terms of why we watch it. It's pure escapism. It allows us to get outside of our head. I coach a lot. And even if there are times when you're going through, you know, sort of challenging times, you know, in your own personal life, now, you know, thankfully I've got a great life. I'm really happy, you know, beautiful wife, four healthy, lovely kids, everything else. But there are moments when, you know, being out on the field allows you to escape from whatever worries you might have from a work point of view or anything else. And there's friends of mine that have been coaching that have gone through, you know, tough times. But when you're out there on the side of a pitch, you're completely escaped. And yeah. So it is, there's always that moment of escapism, of inspiration, of wanting to, you know, to live our life almost through the, you know, the feats of others. And yeah, there was an extent where in the Paralympic side of it, maybe it did, maybe it sort of it veered a little bit, but there was, you know, but there was also some wonderful advertising there that almost, you know, sort of poked fun at that as well.
Yeah.
Like Channel 4, when Channel 4 were covering the Paralympics, they had a brilliant, you know, half hour show on every night as well. And they were basically taking, you know, taking a laugh out of themselves for, yeah. you know, for disability, which is real life. Mm-hmm. That's where it sort of gets to. You know, but still, you know, what Ellen was able to achieve, what Michael McKillop was able to achieve, what Niamh was able to achieve, and so many others in that space. And also in the, you know, with learning disability, Special Olympics, like when you saw what they were doing down in Abu Dhabi, you know, there is a sense that, okay, you kind of need to check yourself and say, am I watching this? Am I being moved for the right reasons in this? But yes, you are.
Yeah.
And if a sponsor comes on board and tries to dial that up, they need to be sensitive to the fact that you're working with the athletes as well. So Ellen Keane doesn't want to be seen as just an inspiration for people who have a physical disability. She wants to be a winner.
Yeah.
And that's what makes her special. She is an inspiration. But if you set out, if your role in life is to inspire others, then you're coming at it from completely the wrong perspective.
You're being a bit Tony Robbins about it, like.
You inspire people by doing what you do.
Yeah.
Not by saying, look at me, look at me. That's just never going to work like that.
Do you think that's more an American thing, isn't it? Like that kind of market idea.
You know,
something we can't really tolerate in Ireland a bit.
A little bit. And you know, it's, you know, the emotional stuff, like, you know, in a music, in a song that will move you, there's always a key change where it sort of moves up and it moves into the chorus. And, you know, some of the advertising and some of the stuff around sport can achieve that as well. Like some of the, you know, the brilliant montages at the end of a tournament, uh-huh. like, you know, RCE and Elaine Buckley, the brilliant one on the Women's World Cup this year, you know, and that sort of captures all of those moments. But it was never made as a movie in order to just sort of do it. Like, those are moments which happened.
Yeah.
And they happened because people were trying to compete to the highest level that they possibly could in sport. And that's what it does. That's where we get our inspiration from.
I'm glad you kind of mentioned the Women's World Cup, because it felt like a tipping point for everyone kind of around the world. Like, it was on kind of free-to-air TV, which is massive, you know, for tournaments like that. And, you know, I don't think, you know, I presume you kind of agree that you can't really state the overimportance of free-to-air TV for smaller tournaments like that. Like, I presume you fully get why people are always screaming for free-to-air.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think
Sky is good every once in a while. And as I was saying, like, I love watching Sky for analysis, but then I love watching RT just for the pure, like, you know,
sheer
the woman with the calippo.
Yeah, the conversation starter that free-to-air television brings is of enormous value. I think, you know, we need to pay full credit to RTE and to TG Caja for actually doing that, because even in the men's World Cup, I was in Portugal for a couple of the early games in the Russia World Cup in 2018. And in Portugal, they had the Portuguese games on free to air, and they had a selection of the others, but a lot of the others were behind a paywall.
Okay.
And I think in Ireland and in the UK, we're very fortunate in that we do have public sector broadcasters, public service broadcasters that are really willing to actually sort of, you know, push the boat out on sport. Because, you know, you're right, I love Sky. I love, you know, I love BT Sport. I love being able to watch whatever sport I can, but I'm privileged. I'm in a fortunate position that I can actually afford to pay for that. You know, for most people and for young kids, young families, you really want to be able to see what's happening in front of you. Flip side of that is rugby. Like rugby and the Champions Cup and all of the sort of the high points of Leinster and Munster over a period of 20 years were all behind a paywall.
Yeah.
So it was only when it came to the Six Nations and, you know, occasionally sort of, you know, other international matches. But for the most part, all of the stuff that was really happening strong in Irish rugby was happening behind a paywall. So sometimes you overstate that as well. Like the people, if people are willing to actually, you know, really want to get behind a winning team, then they will find a way. Mm-hmm. They might not be able to see it live, but they do get to see it. And these days with social media and with YouTube, you can always get to see the goals. You can get to see the big moments. And I think, you know, there's a great campaign 2020, which is out at the moment now, which is the tagline is "You can't see, you can't be."
Yeah.
And it applies specifically to women in sport, but it applies to all sport. If you can't see great things happening in sport, in athletics, in rowing, in football, in hurling, then you're just not going to have that same level of inspiration. So you're right. The Women's World Cup, I think it'll be funny. I genuinely believe that in 8 years' time, in 12 years' time, we'll look back and we'll see, as you referenced today, what seemed like a small tournament and a tipping point. You know, I think that the quality of play was brilliant. I think that the quality of individuals that were involved in it was brilliant. And, you know, funnily enough, people are waking up to the fact that just because you're a man or a woman doesn't actually mean that the sport which you produce is going to be of a vastly different quality. And we've got, again, sponsorship. You've got Barclaycard that are putting millions now into the Women's Premier League over in England. There'll be a natural spillover on that. We've got brilliant players like Louise Quinn that will benefit from that investment in it as well. And so, you know, sponsorship, visibility, bringing women's sport to the fore, I just think it will make it more normal. And, you know, let's be honest, you know, 50.8% of the population at the moment are women. So
yeah.
Why haven't you got a right to be seen as being great sporting athletes?
From like a purely business point of view now, and take like the morality and stuff out of it, I was like curious to get your opinion on, like, they were discussing at the Women's World Cup, should the Arsenal women's games be on before the Arsenal men's games? And I remember someone said, no, they shouldn't, because they should be an atmosphere and like an event on their own, because they deserve that. But at the same time, then you go to an Arsenal women's game and there's only about 800 to 1,000 there. If you were in charge of doing that, how would you, like, not like an in-depth business model here, like, but how would you make sure that it was an event on its own, but making sure that the crowd were coming in to see it, like making sure it was worth it from a financial point of view? Because at the end of the day, like, it's financial. Like, sports is, like, everyone wants to,
it is,
you know, make a profit.
I think one of the things that you've got to take on board what the athletes themselves are looking for as well. I'm lucky to know Fiona Coughlan, who captained Ireland to win the Grand Slam on the women's rugby side. And she was involved on the first game that was played in the Aviva Stadium, where they came on after one of the men's international matches. And they played, a lot of the people had left the stadium because the kind of, you know, the rugby tradition, you watch the match and then you go and you meet your friends and out in the bars and things like that around. I think it's really important to give the players full respect for what they're achieving. And again, you know, not a great campaign at the moment. Effort is equal. I know from, you know, my daughter is involved in the Dublin football setup, you know, at minor level and training with the senior team now for a few weeks. But you see the energy and you see the effort that they're putting into their preparation for an All-Ireland and a championship match. And there is no difference in terms of what they're doing with what the men are doing. They are putting in exactly the same hard yards. You know, they're sweating blood in order to achieve their aims. They should be given the same platform, the same visibility. It's down to us as fans to actually come through on that.
Yeah.
Now, Dublin ladies football team used to play in Portmarnock, their matches. Mm-hmm. And I was as guilty as anybody. I've got two boys and two girls. And when I bring them to Dublin, you bring them to Croke Park because it's easier and it's bigger and you just feel as though it's better. So I'd bring them there, but my two lads would be able to see themselves as Bernard Brogan scoring the winning goal. It dawned on me that my two daughters, even though they're playing football to a very high degree and every other sport under the sun as well, they're not able to see it. So I made a point of wanting to actually get involved and going along to see more of the women's international matches. But that was me. That was my choice to make. And that's what every parent, every father of a daughter, every brother of a sister, every son of a mother should, if they're into sport, be bringing their girls along and going along themselves to see what the girls can do. And if that makes it easier, and the Ladies Football Association has been really good in terms of getting into the right stadium, if it happens to be on a, on a double header with a men's game, then there will be a bigger crowd there, because that's the way that we have to go at the moment. We have to try and, and climb the ladder to actually reach the same standard, the same level. Ladies football final last year, 50,000 people in Croke Park. Brilliant atmosphere, but still 32,000 and change shorter than was there for the men's final. So there's still a way to go. And you want to give them the platform to be the stars of the show.
Yeah.
And being second fiddle and a sort of a starter for the men's event doesn't quite get there.
Because that's what Aoife Murray was saying, the Cork Camogie goalkeeper. She was saying, I'm not playing second fiddle to an under 20.
No,
like, as a 30-year-old, I can't, it doesn't sit right with me watching someone under the age, 18, playing to bigger crowd, and I have to play before him.
Yeah, and that happened for a couple of years where the under 20 and the Camogie finals were on the same bill, so to speak. She's right. The Camogie finals, the ladies' football finals, whether it be hockey, whether it be soccer, they deserve their place in the sun. It's down to us as fans in order to actually go along and support that, because you're right. There is a financial equation in this, in that, if you're renting out Croke Park, or if you're renting out, it might be O'More Park, there's a cost to that. There's a cost in terms of getting the stewards, getting all of the facilities that enable a big stadium to take place. So you have to match that. But that shouldn't be down to the team to match that. The team has got to be given the support, the same support. Like, as a Dublin fan, I would be equally keen to go and see the Dublin ladies playing as I would see the Dublin men, as I would see the Dublin under 20s. And I think that that's the kind of thing which we need to see as individuals out there, because, you can't embarrass people into saying, I hate this idea that, women should support women, and therefore it's down to women to actually sort of, to make the crowd bigger at a women's game. So rubbish. It's down to sports fans to actually make it work, because the kind of quality of play, it's different. It might not be as fast. It might not be as strong. But what they lack in that, they might make up for in skill, or in speed of thought, or having that sort of moment to actually make a switch. And, a one-point game in ladies' football is just as exciting as a one-point game in men's hurling. Absolutely no doubt about that.
Yeah.
So, it's down to us as sporting fans to actually go there and lend our support to them. And for them, yes, make it as easy as possible for us. Let us know when the games are taking place. Get media involved in it, which is happening to a much greater extent now, and getting people talking about it. And then it will happen. So there's probably a mix. You want to put it on the biggest stadia and the biggest occasions in order to get a bit of visibility. But for the ladies' football final, the thought of putting that on the same day as a men's football final, ridiculous, because both of them are at the same stage now where they will attract a crowd of 50,000 plus into Croke Park to actually see it. And you don't want to be diluting that. You want to give them their moment in the sun like everybody else.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I was always thinking, from a purely business model, as I said, if we take the morality out of it, then that's probably the easiest way to go, to make sure it's a double header. As I said, just to make it at least tick over, on the financial records, to make it look, because if you're packaging something, I remember when we were at the Women's Rugby World Cup, I remember we went to the UCD and my dad was like, this should be on in the Aviva. And I was like, it should be, whatever. And then we got to UCD and UCD was full and the atmosphere was much better than what it would be in the Aviva. And I remember dad saying, this would be much easier to package, from a highlights point of view, because you have fans screaming in a non-empty stadium.
It was brilliant. And one of the best things about that, about the Women's Rugby World Cup, was that the games were selling out as well. So there's something extra special about that. If I know that I can just turn up 5 minutes before and actually get into the ground, then that's one thing. But if I realise that I have to actually book in advance, and there was all of the Ireland games and a couple more of them were completely sold out in UCD, and then up in you know, up in Belfast as well for the finals. Like, you know, I'm not a rugby expert, but I could see that the quality of that Women's Rugby World Cup final was probably one of the best rugby games that I would have seen that year.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter that it was women. It didn't matter that it was women versus men, you know, women as opposed to men. It was the fact that this was a World Cup final with everything on the line, and they just went for it hell for leather. You know, we were delighted. We had Joy Neville refereeing it as well, so there was some Irish influence in it. But you're right, you know, creating the right sense of atmosphere, creating the, you know, getting it right at every stage, but also being ambitious to move it up to the next point on the scale as well. Like, you know, we're mad in Ireland. We're mad for sport. You know, the notion, you know, people look at it from the outside and they see that there might be a crowd of, you know, 82,000 filling Croke Park for an amateur sport. That's bigger than any Premier League grounds would attract on a weekend. It's bigger than would be at the Men's World Cup final in football or in rugby or anything else. But we do that out of a city of 1.4 million people in Dublin, out of a country of 4.5 million people in Ireland. Like, it's mad.
Yeah.
But we are mad for sport. Key thing being that we're mad for winners. You know, we should never lose sight of the fact. I know Munster Rugby would have always sort of had a sense that this is in the DNA of fans, that they'll turn up for everything. But when Munster went through a rocky patch, they weren't turning up.
Yeah.
So we do, you know, there's so much. We love sport so much. There's always a winner somewhere along the line, whether it's, you know, Gary and Paul O'Donovan. We'll all love rowing. Whether it be, you know, Annalise Murphy. We'll all love sailing. The hockey women from, you know, from 2018. We all love hockey, but we move along quite quickly as well. So there's a window to catch our attention from a fan's point of view, from a sponsor's point of view, from the sport's point of view, because there is always something just around the corner that we'll be able to go to and cheer and get our escape, isn't it?
That was part one of our interview with Rob Hartnett, CEO of Sports for Business. Tune in next week for episode 4, where we talk about the split for equal play, equal pay, and what that means from a business point of view and the sports involved. Cheerio!
The Big Red Bench.
Game on!
Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m.